Roman numeral 3 under the medieval period has to do with the anti-hierarchical movements. This has to do with movements that actually opposed, for religious reasons, the Roman Catholic Church's hierarchy. In some of the movements we will look at, political reasons also play a part, but in none of them were political reasons the dominating force. I use the term anti-hierarchical. It's more accurate than, well, heretical. Some of the movements probably were heretical, but heretical was equivalent to anti-hierarchical during this period, of course, from the standpoint of the Roman Catholic papal sacral ideal. Many and various were the heretical movements of the high and waning Middle Ages. It is not always easy to discern the relation between them, and it's not always easy to discern their doctrinal beliefs because the historical records are scanty and most often Catholic and therefore prejudiced in their authorship. The movements we will examine are the most famous and probably the most important. A, the movements associated with the High Middle Ages. 1, the Waldenses, 2, the Albigenses, and then B, the movements associated with the waning Middle Ages. After an introduction on the anti-hierarchical scholastics, we'll look at Wycliffe and Huss. I am not certain that we'll get through all this material in this lecture. A, then, the movements associated with the High Middle Ages. Introduction. The timing of the anti-hierarchical movements of the High Middle Ages is significant. They surfaced in the 11th century as a reaction against the growing papal Christian synthesis of which we have spoken. Quote, the centralization of ecclesiastical authority in the papacy was met by a widespread counter-movement of religious individualism and dissent. It was when the theocratic program of Gregory VII and Innocent III was being pressed most vigorously that an ominous spiritual revolt showed itself in communities of dissenters. While the crusading armaments were battling against the infidel abroad, heretical depravity, to use the official term, arose in the church at home to disturb its peace. 1. The Waldenses. And first of all, let's say something about their names. As Verdine points out, during the Middle Ages, names for heretic did not maintain a specific denotation for long. They tend to get blurred across different movements. So this lends a confusing element to the whole study. They became smear words and soon applied to all heretics in general. Nevertheless, certain titles are generally used to describe the specific Waldensian heretics. The Waldensians, the Vaudois, the Poor Men, or Humiliati, of Lyon and of Lombardy. The etymology of the term Waldensian is uncertain. A common derivation is found in the name of Peter Walto, in whom this group first definitely surfaces historically. Others derive it from the canton of Vaud, which became a Waldensian refuge. That would be in Switzerland, modern Switzerland. B, their origin. Most modern historians trace the Waldenses to the late 12th century and Peter Waldo. Some think it probable they existed prior to that time. Since, 1, Cunningham's work was published in 1862, and 2, Verdine's work is noticeably slanted in favor of the heretics, and 3, no other of the 10 or so historians I've read even mentioned this possibility, I must conclude that the Waldensians originated with Peter Walto in the late 12th century. Schaff says, according to the anonymous writer of Passau, writing in the early years of the 14th century, some already in his day carried the origin of the sect back to the apostles. Until recently, all Waldensian writers have claimed for an apostolic origin, or gone at least as far back as the 7th century. Professor Comba of the Waldensian school in Florence has definitely given up this theory in deference to the investigations of Dieckhoff, Herzog, and other German scholars. Comba, professor in the Waldensian College of Florence, accepts the conclusions of modern research and gives up the claim of ancient origin, even apostolic origin, being claimed by the older Waldensian writers. Waldo's life is obscure. He was a prosperous merchant of Lyon. He experienced a spiritual awakening and went to see his priest. Schaff remarks, Waldo sought counsel from a priest who told him there were many ways to heaven, but if he would be perfect, he must obey Christ's precepts and go sell all that he had and give to the poor and follow him. It was the text that had moved Anthony of Egypt to flee from society, and which had been so frequently misunderstood and misinterpreted since then. Waldo renounced his wealth, put his two girls in a convent, provided for his wife, and gave the rest of his wealth away. This event is variously dated from 1161 to 1176. Waldo prevailed on a priest to quickly, Waldo prevailed on a priest to provide with him with a vernacular translation of the Bible and gave himself to preaching. He quickly gained followers. The Archbishop of Lyon tried to stop them from preaching. In 1179, they appealed for recognition to Pope Alexander III during the Third Lateran Council. The Pope refused this permission. Walter went on preaching. In 1184, the poor men of Lyon were anathematized by the Synod of Verona. Their development. The Waldensi spread quickly. In northern Italy, another heretical group joined their ranks. These were known as the Humiliati. Later, that group would split from the group headed by Waldo, resenting his authoritarian leadership. The Pope took advantage of this dissension and organized a Catholic lay group of the poor. Many of the Humiliati rejoined the Catholics through this means. The Popes had learned their lessons well when Francis of Assisi came asking similar sanction for himself and his followers as Peter Waldo had a generation earlier. He would receive papal approval. Waldensi spread into Austria, Germany, and Poland. Their organization. After his condemnation in 1184, Waldo organized his followers along the lines of a religious order. The recruits for this order were drawn, however, from a large body of lay sympathizers, either doctrine. In their earliest period, the Waldenses were not heretics from the Catholic viewpoint. Schaff asserts, in their earliest period, the Waldensians were not heretics, although the charge was made against them that they claimed to be the only imitators of Christ. Closely as they and the Cathari were associated geographically, we'll talk about the Cathari in a second, and by the acts of councils, papal decrees, and literary refutations of heresy, the Waldensians differ radically from the Cathari. They never adopted Manichaean elements, nor did they repudiate the sacramental system of the established church and invent strange rites of their own. They were also far removed from mysticism and have no connection with the German mystics as some of the other sectaries had. They were likewise not Protestants, for we seek in vain among them for a statement of the doctrine of justification by faith. It is possible they held to the universal priesthood of believers, according to De Bourbon and others. They declared all good men to be priests. He placed the stress upon following the practice of the apostles and obeying the teachings of the Sermon on the Mount, and they did not know the definition which Luther put on the word justification. Three fundamental and formative principles, doctrinal principles, may be mentioned. They refused to obey the hierarchy of the church, saying we ought to obey God. Two, they held the sole authority and made popular use of the scriptures. And three, they held that all believers had the right to teach and preach. With these fundamental principles, the Waldenses would soon become unorthodox in Catholic estimation. Some denied purgatory and infant baptism. They denied that sinful priests could perform the sacraments. And they denied prayers, alms, and masses for the dead and transubstantiation. To these things, there may be added that they rejected oaths and the death penalty, precursors then of the later Anabaptist. They centered in their preaching on the Sermon on the Mount. F, their sanctity or godliness. Even their enemies testified to this. Verdine comments, the following fragments of medieval poetry indicate that the quality of lifestyle practiced by the medieval heretics was clearly distinguishable from that of their neighbors. These fragments also record some of the terms of opprobrium used against these conscientious believers. In my translations, I have tried to reproduce rhyme and meter in English where it occurs in the original language. And here's one such rhyme. If there is a good man who loves and fears Jesus Christ, who can't be made to curse, nor swear, nor lie, nor commit adultery, nor kill, nor take from others, nor avenge himself as of enemies, they say he is vaudé and deserves to be punished. In this narrative poem, we read of a person who draws back from the profligacy of the times and receives for it the following rebuke. You shame us all with your beggard behavior. A little further in this poem, a virtuous young woman stays back from participation in the lascivious dances planned for the wedding celebration of her more worldly sister. She gets a severe tongue-lashing for her alleged prudery. The bride, she was a noble wife, haughty and proud, who all her life was all for worldly fun. She spoke against the pious one and said, "Well, darling sister mine, if you must play the beguine or be of beggared stripe, then find you women of the type that go for that. This I advise. Take truant conduct from mine eyes. I'll have you play and laugh and jest and merry make with all the rest." Again, we see a person who gets his ears boxed for his attempt at a Christian lifestyle. "Out in the open, Popelard, you with long and flowing beard, who poses as of men the best, loud criticizing all the rest, your ear this way, you worthless bloke, who picks his friends among beggared folk." Interesting stuff. Okay. But those were typical names for Waldensians. G, their persecution and persistence. Early in the 13th century, the Waldenses suffered in the crusade announced against the Albigenses in southern France. The Inquisition of the 14th century also resulted in suffering in their ranks. In both these periods, their sufferings were comparatively minor. It was in the persecutions begun by Pope Innocent VIII in 1487 and continued through the 16th and 17th centuries that the Waldenses suffered most bitterly. Schaff notes, Innocent VIII, notorious for his official recognition of witchcraft, was the first papal persecutor to resort to rigorous measures. In 1487, he announced a crusade and called upon Charles VIII of France and the Duke of Savoy to execute the decree. Everything the Waldenses had endured before, as Legger says, was as roses and flowers compared with what they were now called upon to suffer. Innocent furnished an army of 18,000. The Piedmontese Waldenses were forced to crouch up higher into the valleys and were subject to almost incredible hardship. The most bitter sufferings of this Israel of the Alps were reserved for the 16th and 17th centuries after they had accepted the Reformation. It was of the atrocious massacres perpetrated at that time that Milton exclaimed, "Avenge, O Lord, thy slaughtered saints, whose bones lie scattered on the Alpine mountains cold." The Austrian-German Waldenses funneled into the Reformation via the Hussite movements. The Swiss Alpine Waldenses survived all the persecution and persist to this day. They adopted the Calvinistic Reformation in the 16th century. So interesting stuff there. And encouraging stuff, not quite so much with the Albigenses, however. Their names. This heretical group of the High Middle Ages was known by several names. Cathars, equal pure, something like puritanical. Puritan, later, was used. It was a smear word. Albigenses, from one of their chief centers, Albi in the south of France. Paterines, from the section of Milan they inhabited, which was the abode of junk dealers, so they were called junk dealers, and New Manichaeans from what was thought to be their theological dualism. Their development, its timing. Catharism broke out in Western Europe in the mid-12th century. There are some indications of minor outbreaks of it in the 11th century. To its center. Its center was southern France, where it even came to be supported by the nobility. Three, its cause. The reason the Cathars found their center in southern France may have been because the church was particularly corrupt in that area. It is interesting to note the major new monastic orders of the 12th century also originated in the same region. Four, its spread. The spread of Catharism was phenomenal. It spread into Spain, Italy, as well as France. In large areas of northern Italy and southern France, it may have constituted nearly a majority or more than a majority of the population. C, their annihilation. The church opposed and eventually annihilated the Cathars by three means. The crusade against the Albigenses, 1181 to 1229. The Inquisition beginning in 1184. This is the origin of the Inquisition, by the way. And three, the Dominican preachers in 1215. Williston Walker says, "The Cathari and Waldenses profoundly affected the medieval church. Out of an attempt to meet them by preachers of equal devotion, asceticism, and zeal, and of greater learning grew the order of the Dominicans. In the same atmosphere of apostolic poverty and literal fulfillment of the commands of Christ in which the Waldenses flourished, the Franciscans had their birth. In these two orders, medieval monasticism had its noblest exemplification. In Francis of Assisi, medieval piety had its highest and most inspiring representative." Dominic was a native of Calaroga. Castile, and was born in 1170. A brilliant student in Palencia and a youth of deep religious spirit, he became a canon of Osma, about 90 miles northeast of Madrid. From 1201, he enjoyed the friendship of a kindred spirit, Diego of Acevedo, the Bishop of Osma. The two journeyed on political business in 1203 through southern France, where the Cathari were then in the height of their power. There they found the Roman missionaries treated with contempt. At a meeting with these missionary leaders in Montpellier in 1204, Diego urged a thorough reform of method. Only by missionaries as self-denying, as studious of apostolic piety, and as eager to preach as the perfect of the Cathari could these wanderers be won back to the Roman fold. Their character. First of all, the question as to their character by way of introduction. The points I've already laid before you in relation to the Albigenses are straightforward and undisputed. When we come to discuss the character of the Albigenses, we enter an area which has been a battleground in previous times. Battle has raged over the origins, doctrines, and ethics of the Albigenses. Yet in reality, the question at issue is one. Were the Albigenses really the new Manichaeans of the High Middle Ages? This question involves the areas of origins, doctrines, and ethics, but is substantially the same question in each area. Well, most historians that I have read, 10 or so, assume that the answer to the question is yes. Cunningham, writing 135 years ago, comes to a radically different conclusion. The leading historical positions maintained upon this subject by Bossuet and other papists are these. First, that the Albigenses and Waldenses were two sects entirely different from each other in their origin, their location, their doctrine, and their character. Secondly, that the Albigenses settled chiefly in the southeast provinces of France, were the descendants of the Paulicians who came from the east and were like them Manichaeans, and that consequently they cannot be regarded even by Protestants as preserving the succession of apostolic doctrine. With regard to the alleged Manichaeism of the Albigenses, it is true that this charge was usually brought against them by their persecutors and by the popish writers of the period, but it is just as true, and we have had on the same authority, that they themselves constantly denied that they held any Manichaean principles, that they persisted in this denial to their martyrdom, and that no evidence was produced either at the time or afterwards that they held the Manichaean doctrine of two principles, original and eternal, or any of its legitimate consequences. So that we have in substance just the averment of their persecutors, burdened with the drawback of their having concurred in or approved of their having been put to death for conscience sake, and on the other hand, their own denial of the charge accompanied and followed by everything that could give it weight. The whole history of the Albigenses, especially of the way in which they were calumniated and persecuted by the Church of Rome, irresistibly reminds us of the calumnies and persecutions directed against the primitive Christians in the second and third centuries, and the whole character and conduct of these men, as it appears incidentally and unintentionally even in the narratives of their persecutors, is fitted to impress the mind with a strong conviction that these victims of the cruelty of papal Rome were men of the same character and principles as the earlier victims of pagan Rome. Upon the whole, we think it has been proved that there is no satisfactory evidence. The great body of those who, under the name of Albigenses, were in the 12th and 13th centuries persecuted by the Church of Rome to almost entire extermination, held Manichaean errors, and there is no reason to doubt that they were martyred because, in opposition to the papacy, they faithfully and honestly maintained apostolic Protestant doctrine, and that having been slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held, they are still crying, "How long, O Lord, holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell upon the earth?" Wow, okay. But I am compelled to disagree with Cunningham on this point, and this for the following reasons. A, the other historians consult and disagree with Cunningham, or rather they fail even to admit that any question may exist. These historians have a wide range of denominational background, liberal Baptist, Anglican, liberal Lutherans, German Reform, a liberal Methodist, a liberal Presbyterian. B, Cunningham, 125 years ago, was writing without the benefit of any of the modern historical research. C, Cunningham was writing under the pressure of Protestant Catholic debate, which may have lessened his objectivity. D, most importantly, Leonard Verdine admits, he's the advocate of these groups, that the Albigenses were infected with Manichaean traits. The name Cathar may have been the most effective in the church's smear campaign, for it harked back to the days when it was used to label a sect that had a concept of ultimate dualism at the center of its theology. This sect had taught that good and evil are equally ultimate. The Manichaeans, from whose heirs Augustine had to fight himself free, had been such Cathars. They had taught that the Old Testament is the work of the evil principle and the New Testament the work of the good principle. Because the post-Constantinian heretics were committed to progressive grace and were thus aware of the preliminary quality of the Old Testament, the church, in its endeavor to eliminate its rival, grasped the possibility of accusing it of the dualism of the older heretics, of pitting the father against the son, as it was sometimes put. In any event, we may by and large dismiss the charge of dualism as a feature of the medieval heretics, although it is a little too sweeping to say that there was not a trace of dualism anywhere. There certainly were dualistic traits in some eruptions of medieval heresy, for example, in Albigensianism. The same is true of the Bogomils in the Balkan areas. But it is very significant that there were reports of sharp dissension between the heretics and these sects. The Orthodox heretics seemed to have been aware of the dualism, which they put far from themselves. What are we to make of the charge of dualism? Considering Verdarin's pro-heretic-based bias, his testimony on this matter is of great significance. E. Gonzalez distinguishes absolute and mitigated Catharism. This reminds us that a wide spectrum of viewpoints may have been present in the Albigensian movement. We may conclude this introductory discussion of the question as to whether the Albigensians were new Manichaeists with a clear, though qualified, yes. Our treatment of the new Manichaeists, then, will be as follows: their doctrinal character, their organizational character, their ethical character, and their genealogical character. 1. Their doctrinal character. While remembering that there was a mitigated Catharism, I will deal with a pure Catharism. The Cathars were dualistic and ascetic. They rejected infant baptism, indeed all baptism whatsoever. Schaff says, the consolamentum took the place of baptism and meant more. Its administration was treated by the Catholic authorities as equivalent to an initiation into heresy, hereticatio, as it was called. The usual form in which the court stated the charge of heresy was, he has submitted to hereticatio. Wow. The right, what could be worse than that? It sounds awful, doesn't it? Hereticatio. Well, the rite, which women also were allowed to administer, was performed with the laying out of hands and the use of the Gospel of John, which was imposed upon the head or placed at the candidate's breast. The candidate made a confession of all his sins of thought, word, work, and vision, and placed his faith and hope in God and the consolamentum which he was about to receive. The kiss of peace followed. They practiced, at least many of them, a kind of Lord's Supper. In this rite, only consecrated bread was used. It should not be thought that the philosophical dualism of the Cathars was the point of their wide appeal. Catharism was not primarily a philosophy. The great appeal of the Cathars was their emphasis on ascetic, ethical purity and their fervent condemnation of the corrupt Roman Church. Seberg perceptively remarks, the Cathari, indeed, in keeping with their Oriental origin, revived with various modifications almost the entire Gnostic system, i.e. Manichaeism, two gods, Gnostic Christology, dualism, etc. But even these agitations culminated practically in the ideas that the Romish Church was the whore Babylon, her hierarchs Pharisees, and her sacraments invalid. Whereas the Cathari were the only holy church with the true and holy hierarchy and effectual sacraments. The good Christians and the true imitators of Christ are persecuted by the church, which is not a church, but only they can actually release from sin by their baptism and penance, their consolamentum and melioramentum. The differences between the Albanenses and Concordensi were of a theological character concerning the nature of God and the origin of matter. The Albigenses were strict dualists. Matter is eternal and the product of the evil God. Paul speaks of the things which are seen as dung. The Concordensi seem to have rejected dualism and to have regarded evil as the creation of Lucifer, the highest of the angels. In matters of ritual and practical conduct and an antagonism to the church establishment, all groups of the Cathari were agreed. Since Schmidt wrote his History of the Cathari, it has been common to represent Catharism as a philosophical system, but it is difficult to understand the movement from this standpoint. How could an unfettered folk, as they were, be concerned primarily or chiefly with a metaphysical construction? Theirs was not a philosophy, but a daily faith and practice. This view alone makes it possible to understand how the movement gained such rapid and widespread acceptance in the well-ordered and prosperous territory of southern France, a territory in which Cluny had exercised its influence and was located. Their organizational character. There is a surprising similarity between the organization of Catharism and the organization of Manichaeism. There was basically a two-level division. There were the perfect, full Cathar, and the believers, the adherents of Catharism, who, while not full members, hoped to become so. The perfect became such by the rite called consolamentum. In this rite, the perfect laid hands on a believer. From this point, the perfect had to lead a life of strict asceticism so as not to fall from grace, involving poverty, chastity, and fasting. Since the life of the perfect was so rigorous, many believers looked forward to salvation by receiving the consolamentum at the end of their life. Perfect were the clergy of the Cathars, while believers would correspond to Catholic catechumens before baptism. Their ethical character. Some historians give some credence to the claims of the Albigenses' contemporaries that they were moral. G.S.M. Walker, setting a rigid standard, G.S.M. Walker argues, setting a rigid standard of perfection for its full members, while at the same time allowing an extreme laxity of the mere adherents, Catharism appealed simultaneously to the highest and basest motives in human nature. Refined and well-born ladies were drawn into the ranks of its elect. Licentious noblemen were assured of liberty to sin on condition of a deathbed repentance. As amongst the ancient Gnostics, this double standard of morality sprang from the contempt for matter. When material and spiritual things are utterly divorced, the ideal life may be that of a celibate vegetarian, but indulgence of the flesh cannot seriously harm the soul. With such beliefs, the Cathars were led to the paradoxical conclusion that adultery is less sinful because less permanent than marriage, and if a full member was unable to practice the austerity demanded of him, he was encouraged to end his bodily struggles by committing suicide, starving himself to death in a rite which they called the Endura. It seems clear that the perfect were rigidly and ascetically pure. As to the believers, no doubt the rumors of contemporaries were greatly out of proportion. It is possible, however, given their dualism and asceticism, that there may be an element of truth in Walker's presentation. Fourthly, their genealogical character. Baton states, very different were the Cathari because their ideas were definitely heretical, having been imported from Bulgaria. A few of the number were burned by mobs in France as early as the 11th century, but the large influx is to be attributed to crusaders returning disillusioned from the East. The Cathari, called also Albigenses from the town of Albi, stand in the succession which runs thus: Gnostics, Manichees, Paulicians, Bogomili, Cathari. These groups all have in common a sharp dualism between spirit and matter, and often also between God and the devil. Though there is not great direct evidence for Baton's genealogy of the Cathars, there is good reason by way of inference to accept it. It explains the dualistic tenets of the Cathars. There were dualistic religious groups in Eastern Europe descended from early times. There was definitely contact and influence by these Eastern European groups. Walker notes, by the 11th century, the sect was spreading into Western Europe. Several heretics were put to death at Toulouse in 1022, and since their heresy is described as Manichaean, they doubtless had affinities with the Bosnian Bogomils. 8 years later, a regular congregation appears at Montfort, describing itself by the name of Cathar. This term is derived from the Greek word for pure, and those who bore it claimed to be Puritans, uncontaminated by the worldliness of the official church, unspotted by the evil taint of manner. In southern France, they were known as Albigensians because they had an important center at the town of Albi. In the north, the name Poplicani, a Latinized form of Paulician, betrays the eastern origin of the sect. Soon it had spread into Flanders and Germany, where 7 Cathars were burnt at Cologne in 1163. But 4 years after this, the Albigensians were strong enough to hold a large council near Toulouse, attended by Bishop Nicetas from the Bogomil Church of Constantinople. He ordained more bishops for them delimited their diocesan boundaries and persuaded them to accept a completely Manichaean dualism of two separate gods. Several historians mentioned that the Manichaeism of the Roman Empire had never died out in the Western Europe, and I'm not going to read that long quotation from Williston Walker. So my conclusion is that the genealogy of the Albigenses runs then as follows. The remnants of the Gnostic heresies of the 1st and 2nd centuries were swallowed up by the Manichaeism of the 3rd, 4th, and 5th. Out of the Manichaean matrix originated the Paulicians in the East during the 6th century. The Paulicians' able warriors were transplanted by the Byzantine Empire to Bulgaria to protect its northern flank against the barbarians. There they prospered, now known as the Bogomils. They even became the state church of Bosnia. In the 12th century, the bishop of that church visited and presided over an Albigensian council. Conclusion, the significance of the Waldenses and Albigenses for theories of visible church succession outside the Roman Catholic Church is now clear. Having examined both these movements, we are now in a position to assess their significance for theories both by Baptists and other Protestants of visible church succession from the apostles. First, let us speak of the Waldenses. Doctrinally, there is very much that is admirable about the Waldenses, of course, yet there is much that is purely medieval in character, and there's no trace of a Protestant doctrine of justification. In the time of Peter Waldo, they were organized as a monastic sect. Historically, several things may be said. During the 12th century, they sought recognition from the Pope. They probably originated during the 12th century. Some slight evidence that they existed before this, perhaps as far back as the 9th century, though this is wholly unproven. There's absolutely no evidence prior to this. Historically speaking, then, the Waldenses do neither Baptist or Protestant successionism much good. And then, in the second place, think of the Albigenses. Here's a fair case for a kind of visible succession. It does appear that a visible line of succession can be traced for the Albigenses back even to the 2nd and 1st centuries. The problem, however, is this. When we arrive at the great-grandfathers of the Albigenses in the 1st and 2nd centuries, they are not the apostles, but the Gnostic heretics. The genealogy which brings one from the 2nd century to the 12th runs through Manichees, Paulicians, and Bogomils, dualistic heretics, every one. All right, that completes our fourth lecture tonight.